All righty, we're underway then with the first regathering, Modern Israel, session number 9, beginning on page 73 of your workbook. We are in the third major section of the class, the end of exile, 1839 to 1947, the modern Zionist movement. So last week we looked at the first Aliyah, when 25,000 Jewish people, mostly from Russia, came into the land of Israel. Here are some of those courageous young people. They were followed by the Biluim, the a movement of young people from Russia that wanted to start independent collective farms. They were socialist in background, and so they were the forerunners of the kibbutz movement. What the Biluim started morphed into the kibbutz movement. Rishon LeZion was founded, but it didn't survive except for the generosity of Baron Edmund James the Rothschild. And he poured a lot of money and effort into the colonies in the land of Israel. Gadara was one of those colonies. And on the left-hand side of the screen, you can see the box that is highlighted on the right-hand side. And, of course, Gadara there is on the lower part of the box. And you can see some of the other settlements that were formulated. Rishon LeZion, Petach Tikva, Rehovot. We talked a little bit about William E. Blackstone, a Gentile, a Bible-believing fundamentalist, a dispensationalist, the first dean of Biola, who campaigned heavily for the Zionist movement and was, as a Gentile, very, very effective and influential in the modern Zionist movement, and a local guy. And he's buried up in Glendale, just about 40 minutes north there, in a very humble circumstances. He's a man basically forgotten by history. We looked at Ahad Ha'am, Asher Ginsberg. He became a very strong writer and force in the modern Zionist movement. Rehovot was established. Hadera was established. And then we came to the life of Theodor Herzl. And we began to look at the beginning of his life. He was an assimilated Austrian, very successful, but he was always bothered by the Jewish question. And he began to write about it more and more as he was a correspondent, a reporter for a French newspaper, a very well-known newspaper. And his concern over the Jewish problem reached its climax with the trial and the framing and the trial of Captain Alfred Dreyfus. Dreyfus was an assimilated Jew, just like Herzl, a loyal member of the French army, and he was framed for being a German spy and humiliated. And Herzl, as a reporter, was required to cover his trial and his humiliation. And at the trial, and when he was marched off to Devil's Island, the crowds chanted, "Death to the Jews, death to the Jews." And right there, Herzl realized assimilation is not the answer. And by the way, God will not allow us to assimilate. And it's not the answer to the Jewish problem. And the result of that revelation was Der Judenstaat, the Jew state, in which he outlined how to formulate a nation for the Jewish people. You can also read that. You can get it on Amazon.com. if you'd like to read it in English, and you can also read it for free on the Jewish Virtual Library. The text is there on the Jewish Virtual Library. So just go to Text Concerning Zion, and you'll find the Jew State, or they've softened it here, the Jewish State by Theodor Herzl. He didn't soften it. He called it the Jew State, because he wanted to throw that term into the face of the anti-Semites. All right, that brings us now to 1897, page 73 in your workbook, the First Zionist Congress. Now, the notion of calling a general Zionist day, which ultimately evolved into the Zionist Congress, was first suggested to Herzl. Notice that. He didn't think it up himself. He wasn't the originator of the Zionist Congress. It was suggested to him in January of 1897 by Willy Bambus and Theodor Lusisti, members of the German Kadima Society. Herzl liked the idea and went with it, but it wasn't his idea to begin with. Official invitations were issued for the gathering, and it was scheduled for late August in Munich, Germany. But The Western Jewish response was one of outrage. You see, the site was denounced, or the idea was denounced as treason to the fatherland by the German Jews, and was considered a danger to Judaism. You can see how assimilated the Jews in Germany were already. They did not consider themselves Israelis or anything like that. They considered themselves Germans. And that, by the way, is where the Reform movement got its start as well. So there was a lot of outrage. And so the site of the Congress was finally shifted to Basel, Switzerland. And here's a Google Eye view of Europe. And there is Basel, or Switzerland, in the middle of the map, Basel, in the northern end. And here's a close-up of the little country of Switzerland, Basel, located on the northern boundary, the northern edge of the country. Here is a photograph of the hall in which the first Zionist Congress convened. So just a standard meeting hall in the town. And this is a picture of Basel today, a thriving Swiss town, very pretty Swiss European town. Now there was delegates from 15 countries, 204 representatives in all were present. And here's all 204 of them. And in the middle, the big guy in the middle is Herzl himself. He was elected president. So there are all the delegates to the First Zionist Congress. Here's another photograph of all the delegates on the floor of the Congress. And this is probably the most famous picture of Theodor Herzl, leaning on the banister there at Basel. You see it all over the place. All righty. Now, during his presentation to the Congress, Herzl emphasized that older models of piecemeal colonization into Palestine, deprived of international legal recognition, were no longer adequate. That's all we've been seeing up to now, right? We've been seeing infiltrationist methods. A new and permanent and official body was required henceforth in order to cope with the Jewish question more directly and forcefully. Yeah, page 74. Now, the aim of Zionism, in Herzl's mind, the aim of Zionism would be, quote, a Jewish homeland openly recognized, legally secured. Now, the achievement of that goal, or for the achievement of that goal, I should say, the Congress approved four steps. Number one, the encouragement of settlement in Palestine by Jewish agricultural workers, laborers, and artisans. So anyway, increase or support immigration any way you can. Secondly, the unification of all Jewry into local and general Zionist groups. So go worldwide and get the worldwide Jewish community behind us. Thirdly, the strengthening of Jewish self-awareness and national consciousness. In other words, this is an attack against assimilation, isn't it? Get Jewish people to identify as Jews and want to live in their homeland. And finally, fourth, diplomatic activity to secure the help of various governments so we can get some political backing behind us. Now, here is, by the way, a photograph of that four-step program, all written out in beautiful script, beautiful longhand. You don't see this anymore, but you can see the 4 points listed on the left side there, 1, 2, 3, 4. No computers in those days. All done by ink on paper. Now, the Congress established as its instrument a permanent Zionist organization, and Herzl was immediately and unanimously elected president of the Zionist organization. Now, after 3 days of discussion, everything was finally concluded with the singing of a Hebrew anthem, HaTikvah. HaTikvah, the hope. So, let's take a look at HaTikvah and listen to it. All right. Now, in this production of HaTikvah, you're going to see the Hebrew and a transliteration of the Hebrew at the top. And at the bottom, you'll see an English translation. So we're going to go through the song twice. First time through, take a look at the words at the top, okay? So you can get a transliteration of the Hebrew. And then the second time through, read the English at the bottom so you'll know what you're singing, okay? So let's see if I can get this thing to work here. Now it should pick up in the noise, in the sound a little bit. So if you can't hear me, let me know and I'll push up the sound a little bit. All right, this particular rendition goes through the song four times, and we're not going to do that. We'll go through it twice, and remember now, look at the words at the bottom now so you can understand the meaning of the song. Now that song was the unofficial anthem of Israel until recently. It's now the official national anthem of the State of Israel. All right. Now Herzl had anticipated the need not only for a national anthem, he had also anticipated the need for a flag. And both a national anthem and a flag were available at the First Zionist Congress. Here is a sketch in Herzl's diary of a proposed flag for the Zionist movement. It originally looked like this. A couple of stripes were added to make it look like a tallit, and it had this kind of fancy star and lion in the center, and that was all simplified down to what we have today. So here is the national flag of Israel as well. But Herzl was thinking ahead, wasn't he? Some of the details you would like to have for your country. Now, in his diary, later in his diary, Herzl wrote this. If I were to sum up the Basel Congress in a single phrase, which I would not dare make public, I would say. Now, why wouldn't he want to make this public? Well, here it is, you guys. You'll see it in just a moment. In Basel, I created the Jewish state. He's just usurped the glory of God, hasn't he? Yep, a little bit of arrogance put him over the line. In Basel, I created the Jewish state. All right. Now, the first Zionist Congress gave a powerful impetus to Zionist propaganda throughout the world. Hundreds of societies were formed, and they augmented the old Chovev Yitzion groups, and they were in affiliation with the Zionist organization. So the Zionist organization expanded tremendously, and the membership climbed steadily. So Herzl was really the launching pad to get the Zionist movement, the official Zionist movement, going instead of the unofficial and disorganized little Chovev Yitzion groups. All right, 1898, top of page 75 here, the Second Zionist Congress. In August of 1898, a Second Zionist Congress was convened, also in Basel, and this time the number of delegates had risen to 349, up from 204. So we had 145 more delegates. And here's a picture of the Second Zionist Congress in action. And Theodor Herzl is at the podium. You can see him there at the podium delivering some kind of an address. So this is the Second Zionist Congress. Now, among the new representatives would be those who would emerge as the future giants in the movement. And one of those new representatives was a man we'll encounter more and more in our study, Chaim Weizmann. He will pop up over and over and over again. Now, at the Second Congress, detailed reports were given, not merely on the circumstances of diaspora Jewry, but also on the circumstances of Palestinian Jewry as well. Leo Motzkin, whom the Zionist organization had sent to Palestine, now warned. He had a negative report. He warned that under current legal restrictions, a mass migration to the Holy Land was impossible. You know, the Holy Land was under the thumb of the Ottomans at this time, so they would never go for mass immigration. But on the other hand, in Herzl's view, infiltration was equally out of the question. It was the very opposite of his entire purpose. So we've got two conflicting purposes here, or two conflicting ways of action. And so a third choice was endorsed by the Congress. And this was to simultaneously improve the unification of the Yishuv by colonization and industrialization, and at the same time to pursue all possible diplomatic efforts to acquire a charter of Jewish settlement in the Holy Land. So we'll try to pursue both tracks at once. 1899, Third Zionist Congress. During the year of 1899, Herzl recognized that German influence was essential to convince the Ottoman Empire to look favorably on a Jewish charter. And eventually he gained an audience with Kaiser Wilhelm II. And you don't have a picture of our humble Kaiser Wilhelm, but there's a picture of him. This is a rather humble picture, by the way. He's dressed very simply. I'll show you a more imperial picture. There's a little less humility involved there. He's got all kinds of ribbons and medals and colors, and he looks much more imperial there. But as I was looking around the web for more pictures of Kaiser Wilhelm II, I came to the one I really like. Here is the one that I just love, and here it comes, you guys. Ta-da! Don't you just love that? He's got that scepter in one hand. He's got his hand on the sword in the other, and he strikes that imperial pose. It just drips of arrogance, doesn't it? But you know, I think that might be nice for my official pose for Hadavar. What do you think? Do you think I ought to Photoshop my face in there? I think that'd be great. You know? Okay, enough of that. Question. Oh, yeah, there were people from all streams of Judaism. Yeah, all streams. Yes, question.
Did they get harassed for having it?
No. No, there was no harassment at all. As long as they were out of Germany, the German Jews were happy, you know, we're not upsetting the Germans, you know. No, Switzerland's a neutral country. Yeah, so there was no harassment of any sort, no. All righty. Now, the Kaiser. The Kaiser, by the way, the word Kaiser is a Germanized form of Caesar. Okay, he saw himself as a Caesar. Same thing with Tsar. You know, Tsar of Russia, that's a Russianized form of Caesar. Okay, these guys see themselves as the descendants of Caesar, Rome. Yeah, that's the title they gave themselves. That's a title, yeah. That's their title. Yeah, Kaiser, there were many Kaisers and many Tsars. Okay, like king. But they wanted Caesar. Caesar, okay. All right, the Kaiser was first enthusiastic about the Zionist idea because he thought that he would free his country of politically radical Jews. We'll get those Jews out of here. You know, send them to Israel. That's a great idea. However, when it was made clear that the Ottoman Sultan would have nothing to do with Zionism and nothing to do with an independent Jewish kingdom, the Kaiser dropped the Zionist cause and refused to receive its representatives. So this was a bleak period for Herzl. Now, the Third Zionist Congress met in August of 1899, and Herzl explained his diplomatic efforts and asked drafts of a charter be written. Now, at this meeting, a bank, the Jewish Colonial Trust Fund, was established. This organ would be the depository of funds that were raised for the Zionist organization. However, impatience with Herzl's failing diplomatic efforts was growing. Bottom of page 75 now, we come to the Fourth Zionist Congress. Not surprisingly, the Fourth Zionist Congress meeting in London of August of 1900 was confused and dispirited in its proceedings. So here's a few pictures of the new location for the Congress. Again, Europe, a picture of Europe, but England is in the forefront here. And as we zero in on England, there is the city of London. And of course, there, London is famous for many landmarks. In the foreground is the Tower of London. And in the background, the London Bridge, I believe. And then the very famous Big Ben. Big Ben is a very common symbol of London. And the red British telephone booth and the red double-decker British bus. So you got a lot of symbols of London here in these pictures. So that's where the Fourth Zionist Congress convened. So they're upset with Herzl because the diplomatic track is not going very well. At the same time, Herzl's employers were warning him about ignoring his journalistic responsibilities. And next, his personal fortune was rapidly being depleted by his Zionist expenditures. Page 76, Fifth Zionist Congress. In January 1901, he wrote this in his diary. He's pretty depressed at this point in time. The wind blows through the stubble. I feel my autumn approaching. I see before me the danger of leaving no achievement in the world. In other words, I'm not going to create a Jewish state, and no inheritance for my children, and I'm going to be totally broke very soon. So he's in a very negative spot in his life. Now, on May 17th, 1901, his diplomatic efforts seemed to be bearing fruit. He was received by Sultan Abdul Hamid of the Ottoman Empire. And up on the screen, here's a picture of Sultan Abdul Hamid. I wish that was in color. It would probably be a lot more garish, yeah, than it is in black and white. Now, the meeting received much publicity, and it enhanced the reputation of the Zionist organization, but it bore no practical results. Now, during the Fifth Zionist Congress, again assembled in Basel in December 26, 1901, all Herzl could do was speak of the highest hopes he entertained following his meeting with the Turkish ruler. Now, at this meeting, the Jewish National Fund was established for land buying purposes in Palestine. And this is the modern logo of the Jewish National Fund, the JNF. And in Hebrew, it's the Keren Keyemet LeYisrael. So this is the modern logo. And the Jewish National Fund is very much alive today. This is their current website. If you want to support Israel, you can go to the Jewish National Fund and have a tree planted in your honor or somebody else's honor, and you'll receive this nice little certificate. A few years ago, we had two trees planted in honor of Colonel Ilan Ramon. He was the Israeli astronaut that died in the shuttle disaster. So if you want to plant a tree in Israel, you can do it through the JNF. Still very, very active even today. Now, during the Fifth Zionist Congress, an important concern of Eastern Jewry reached a climax. Now, the concern of the Easterners, led by Ahad Ha'am, Asher Ginsburg, was the obvious lack of Judaic spirit in the activities of secular Herzl and his collaborators. So a group of 37 concerned delegates met and formed a party within the Zionist Congress. This party was not without influence, and it presented a resolution that Herzl endorsed. The resolution affirmed that, quote, "The education of the Jewish people in a national spirit is an essential part of the Zionist program. So don't limit Zionism to politics and secularism. Let's get some Jewish culture in there." Now, the resolution advocated the election of a cultural commission whose members included Ahad Ha'am. So the group served essentially as a rallying point for those devoted to the goals of spiritual or cultural Zionism. So we have another strand of Zionism developing. 1902, Mizrahi founded. As the Zionist organization grew, various parties formed in the movement. And this was a testimony to its strength. Various approaches and philosophies within the movement began taking political form. One of these emerging philosophies was religious Zionism. Now remember, way back at the beginning, we have Rabbi Alkali. He was thinking along the terms of religious Zionism in his writings. Now, religious Zionism was a conscious blending of orthodoxy and Jewish nationalism. Now, the inspiration was provided by Rabbi Samuel Molliver. And here's a picture of the rabbi, Rabbi Samuel Molliver. Now, Rabbi Molliver was an earlier supporter of the Chovevi Zion, the Lovers of Zion. And he was willing to work side by side with the avowed secularists like Herzl. His intention, though, he had a hidden agenda. His intention of working pragmatically with the secularists was to induce his fellow Zionists into religious observance. He wanted to get them back into orthodoxy. All right, page 77. Now, as early as 1893, Molliver had founded a society for promoting his views. And this was called Merkatz Ruchani, or the Spiritual Center, or simply Mizrahi. And Mizrahi still exists today. Here is their latest website, World Mizrahi Movement. And you notice this panel of their website features a biography series of great Zionist rabbis. And you recognize any of those guys? Here we go. On the right, Judah Alkali. See, Judah Alkali was in this stream. And on the left, Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. These were the guys that really started the whole thing off and formulated it. So they are honored by the Mizrahi movement here. So again, still very active today. It was not until the organizational efforts of Rabbi Isaac Jacob Rennes, however, one of the authentic giants of the Zionist history, that the Mizrahi became a conscious political movement within Zionism. Rennes, too, was an early supporter of Chovevi Zion and then of Herzl's political Zionism. Now, in 1902, he restructured the Mizrahi organization as a faction within the Zionist movement, both as a delegate to successive Zionist congresses and as an author of numerous books on religious philosophy. He preached a form of dual redemption, redemption of the land of Israel and redemption of the Jewish spirit. Neither could be accomplished, he argued, except within the precepts of strict orthodoxy, you know, rabbinic Judaism. Now, the contribution of Mizrahi lay in the fact that it made Zionism, which was predominantly secular now, it made Zionism acceptable to traditional elements within Jewish life. You know, the religious elements. So they got on board because of this. Now, even with the accomplishments, Zionism was in the doldrums in 1901 to 1903. And very little progress was being made. It happened then in early 1902 that the British Parliament appointed a royal commission to study the threat of cheap labor posed by the influx of Russian Jews to London's East End. Now, Herzl was asked to appear before the parliamentary body on July 7, 1902, to describe the wretched conditions of East European Jewry and express hope that Britain would continue to offer asylum for the fugitives. Eventually, Herzl was interviewed by Joseph Chamberlain, the British Colonial Secretary. And here's a picture of the current British Colonial Secretary of the time, Joseph Chamberlain. This is the man Herzl met with. Now, Chamberlain listened with interest when Herzl explained to him that Palestine was still the ultimate goal of Zionism, but that negotiations were dragging. Now, Herzl, notice who outlined the plan, who presented the plan. Herzl outlined a plan to Chamberlain for temporary Jewish colonization of either Cyprus or Al-Arish in the northern Sinai Peninsula. So this is Herzl's idea. Here, of course, is Israel, Palestine. This is the ultimate goal of Zionism, but a temporary shelter of the night could be Cyprus, this little island in the Mediterranean, or, if not Cyprus, then the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula in Al-Arish. Now, Cyprus was ruled out immediately. Chamberlain said, nope, nothing doing there. But he did set in motion negotiations regarding Al-Arish. And Herzl then journeyed to Cairo to look into the Al-Arish possibility. The Egyptian government rejected the idea because they didn't like the idea of a Jewish enclave on their territory. Now, Herzl fell into black despair. Even this proposal was unrealized. It's simply done for, he wrote in his diary on May 11th. Now, during this period of ebbing morale, he dashed off a novel, Altneuland, Old New Land. Here's a copy of Altneuland. And this is a weak novel, and it ends with the very famous line, however, "But if you will it, it is no dream." And if you're interested in reading this particular work, it is available on Amazon.com. There are editions of Altneuland available. And if you want to read it for free, you can also go to the Jewish Virtual Library and read it on your computer. So that's another resource for you there as well. All righty, it's time now for your break. And we'll pick it up in 1903 with the East Africa proposal. So go ahead and take your break. All righty, let's pick it up again. Let's pick it up again at 1903, the bottom of page 77, the East Africa proposal. In April 1903, Herzl returned from his ill-fated Cairo trip to report to British Colonial Secretary Chamberlain. Chamberlain unexpectedly dropped another proposal on Herzl's lap. He proposed that the territory for the Jews was British East Africa, erroneously but popularly known as Uganda. So here's our globe, and with Africa in the foreground. There is Israel to the north. That's the ultimate Zionist goal. But British East Africa is way, 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 way down there. This is British East Africa, or popularly known as Uganda. So there was another proposal for a temporary Jewish home. Now, Herzl rejected the idea at first. Go to page 78. As it soon developed, Herzl's commitment to the Holy Land or something nearby was shaken by events in Russia. The next month, in May, a savage pogrom broke out in Kishinev, Russia. Today, this is known as Moldova. Here is the Black Sea, and off on the to the west of the Black Sea is Moldova, and that's the modern city of Chisinau. And we'll see, there's the modern state of Moldova, Ukraine to the east, Romania to the west, and the Black Sea down there on the southeast. And in the middle, there's Kishinev, or Chisinau. So there's where the pogrom occurred, very vicious pogrom. It was so vicious that it made news in the United States. And Teddy Roosevelt was our president at that time. And you can see him here berating the Tsar for weighting down the Jewish people with a load of oppression. Stop your cruel oppression of the Jews. There's Teddy Roosevelt taking the side of the Jewish people there. All righty. So Herzl was shattered by the news of this atrocity. He notified Chamberlain that a Zionist commission of investigation would be sent to British East Africa. And at the same time, he requested that a charter for Jewish autonomy be written. Now, in Herzl's mind, East Africa was not intended as a substitute for Palestine, but rather as a training ground for it. We must have an answer to Kishinev, was his thinking. See, the Jewish people needed something. We needed it right away. So now the Sixth Zionist Congress, middle of page 78, again in Basel, Switzerland. This same mood of concern and urgency was shared by all factions within the Zionist movement following the Kishinev pogrom. This mood of deep concern filled the Basel Assembly Hall on August 22, 1903, as the Sixth Zionist Congress got underway. Some kind of a rescue effort had to be launched, and so East Africa was proposed as an asylum for the night. The reaction was divided and emotional. The resolution to dispatch an investigative commission was passed 295 to 177 with 100 abstentions. So the Sixth Zionist Congress was very deeply polarized. To balance out the East Africa Investigative Commission, a Palestine commission was also appointed to study the circumstances in the Yishuv. But the split soon extended far beyond the meeting hall of the Sixth Congress. Eliezer Ben Yehuda wrote articles in defense of the East Africa proposal. He's in Israel. He's creating the modern Hebrew language, right? And yet he was still in favor of East Africa. Bitter debates and threats and impassioned protests followed. Throughout the Zionist world, family bonds and lifelong friendships were shattered over the issue. Now, while the East Africa proposal created a crisis within Zionism, the availability of East Africa rapidly ended. English colonists strenuously opposed a mass influx of Russian Jews, and the idea faded away into obscurity. Now, a 23-year-old delegate to the Sixth Zionist Congress was a young man named Vladimir Jabotinsky. Here's Vladimir Jabotinsky, also known as Ze'ev Jabotinsky. Now, Jabotinsky was reared in a secular Russian Jewish home. As a youth, he passed directly into Russian life, immersing himself in its literature and its ideals. But Tsarist persecution subsequently shattered his love for Russia. Like Herzl and Nordau, he detected in the vision of a Jewish state an immediate and thrilling opportunity for national freedom and self-assertion. He was overwhelmed by Herzl at the Sixth Zionist Congress and became a fiery advocate of political Zionism. Page 79. For Jabotinsky, as for Herzl, Zionism prefigured a revolution in character as well as a revolution in status. He regarded Zionism as the instrument by which Jews would shuck off their qualities of submissiveness and timidity and become instead bold, proud, and militant. Now, Jabotinsky traveled widely afterward, becoming a versatile linguist. In Italy, Jabotinsky developed his forceful oratorical style with an instinct for the theatrical, and he generated an extraordinary personal magnetism. Ultimately, he would become the single most charismatic figure, the single most appealing figure after Herzl in Zionist history. And as I was reading, a book recently by Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, Jewish Humor, on page 68, I came across a joke that Vladimir Jabotinsky uttered. And this joke is kind of classic. It's an ironic joke about anti-Semitism in Russia, a Jewish joke laced with irony. So here's his joke. A Russian peasant once pronounced this mathematical theory. 4 and 4 make 8. With this we can agree. Some say 5 and 3 also make 8, but that's a Jewish trick. So you see how anti-Semitism works? Very ironic little joke. All right, 1904, death of Theodor Herzl. The bitterness of the crisis had taken its toll on Herzl. Herzl's physical strength was already undermined by his dedication to the Zionist cause. The East Africa struggle was the final assault on his health. A friend was startled by the change in Herzl at this time. Here's what he wrote when he met Herzl from Sakhar, A History of Israel, page 63. The imposing figure was now stooped, the face sallow. The eyes, those mirrors of a fine soul, were darkened. The mouth was drawn in pain and marked by passion. Now, in the late spring of 1904, Herzl suffered a mild heart attack, and on June 3rd, he left for a resort to recuperate. However, on July 1st, 1904, his breathing became labored, he coughed blood, and he lapsed into a coma. And on the afternoon of July 3rd, 1904, Herzl died at the age of 44. Only 44, yeah, young man. Yep. Now, in his will, the Zionist leader had requested that his body be interred in Vienna, next to his father's grave, until, quote, to remain there until the Jewish people carry my remains to Palestine. The funeral took place in Vienna on July 7th. 6,000 people walked behind the cortege. Stefan Zweig recalled the huge procession was dignified. It started out dignified when suddenly a tumult ensued at the cemetery. Too many had suddenly stormed to his coffin, crying, sobbing, screaming in a wild explosion of despair. It was almost a riot, a fury. All order was overturned through a sort of elemental, ecstatic mourning, such as I have never seen before or since at a funeral. And it was this gigantic outpouring of grief from the depths of millions of souls that caused me to realize for the first time how much passion and hope this lone and lonesome man had borne in the world through the power of a single idea. And here's a picture of the, on page 80, and on the screen here's a picture of the cortege, and you can see the 6,000 people that followed it to the cemetery. Now, do you notice the guy in the lower left? He looks to me like he is in the middle of emotional grief there, doesn't he? Maybe he started the whole thing. I don't know. In Aug, question?
He did a lot in his
few years. Well, actually, no. He did very little in his few years. Actually, no. In August 16, 1949, Herzl's remains were flown to Israel. 1949 now. The next day, they were interred on a ridge facing Jerusalem and bearing the name Mount Herzl. And here's a photograph of the reburial of Herzl's remains up on Mount Herzl. This is the honor guard that accompanied the coffin. And this is the way the area looks today. You can visit it today. There's a geodesic dome that's been constructed on the site. And of course, the inscription there is just the name Herzl. And again, here's a close-up of the tomb. Now, you might think that those who take care of this property are being kind of careless because you see all these rocks on the tomb. Well, that's very deliberate. That's a Jewish tradition. In Jewish tradition, we don't put flowers on a grave because flowers rot away and, you know, they're temporary. So when we come to a grave, we just pick up a stone and we place it on the grave or the tombstone because that's more of a permanent memorial. It says, I was here and I care. So Herzl's tomb will always have rocks on it, always have some stones on it. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Theodore Herzl, Moriah Films has produced this hour and a half a documentary, It Is No Dream, and it's a fun documentary to read, to look at, and it'll give you a good insight into the man called Theodore Herzl. So you can get it from Moriah Films, or if you're a Netflixer, you can pick it up on Netflix. It's also available through Netflix as well.
It's a video?
This is a video, yes. Yeah, documentary video of the life of Theodore Herzl. So feel free to avail yourself of that resource if you can. It's to the east of the old city. It's in the vicinity of the Knesset, I think a little bit more to the east of the Knesset. Yeah, question.
Was he married?
Yes, he was married. And it was a very, very poor marriage. His wife was very high-strung and really neurotic. Yeah. So, all righty. Before we go any further, I want to just share with you some thoughts of application. Okay. Remember, Theodore Herzl wrote in his diary, "In Basel, I created the Jewish state." Now, in his ignorance and his arrogance, he was claiming glory. He was claiming credit for what rightfully belongs to God alone. Now, God would not allow Theodore Herzl to usurp his glory without consequences. And the consequences were two in number. Number one, Herzl's tireless efforts to secure the Jewish state through political action failed. Totally failed. He literally burned himself out, exhausted most of his personal fortune, and got absolutely nowhere in the political arena. Every political situation he pursued was a dead end. He did not create the Jewish state. Secondly, the second consequence was premature death. He literally killed himself on behalf of the state of Israel. He was a workaholic, and he was depending on his own efforts to secure success. Now, no one, absolutely no one, expended more dedication and effort on behalf of the Jewish state. But he only lasted 6 years, a scant 6 years after the first Zionist Congress, and he was dead from all the stress and all the effort. Theodore Herzl did not create the Jewish state. He didn't realize that he was standing on the shoulders of all those whom God had used in the previous years. See, God had set the foundation in place. He didn't realize that. Instead, he took credit for himself. In Basel, I created the Jewish state. No, you didn't, Theodore. In Basel, God created the Jewish state. He used you. But you were just the instrument. Now, let's not point a finger at Herzl. Let's not point a finger at Herzl and his mistake. Let's look at ourselves. Are we making the same mistake in our lives? Are we trying to go through life on our own steam, on our own power, without depending on God for guidance and for resources? Are we living life for the glory of ourselves and not for the glory of the living God? If we do, we'll end up just like Theodore Herzl. We'll suffer the consequences of ignorance and arrogance. So let's learn from Theodore Herzl and always strive to live for the glory of God. Let's maintain a realistic view of ourselves. And Yeshua said it in John 15:5. He said, "Apart from me, you can do nothing." Apart from me, you can do nothing. We can do nothing of any eternal value on our own. Oh yeah, we can buy a big house and we can get a fancy car and we can even build a big business. But all that stuff's going to burn. It's not going to be around for eternity. Anything we do of any value in God's eyes is only because of His grace and His decision to use us as His tools. We are His servants, and we're nothing more. What we accomplish in this life, we should humbly use to point to Him and to glorify Him. We should never forget to recognize all the people and all the resources God brought into our lives that contributed to any accomplishments that we made. You know, everybody stands on the shoulders of those who came before. We all do. We don't stand independently. So we should maintain a realistic view of ourselves and thank Him for His grace and for His providence. So, just a word to the wise. Let's not follow the example of Theodore Herzl.
I've got a copy of that.
It's been asked for already, and you will get it next week. You want that one too?
Yes.
All right. Okay, we'll do all the applications. All righty. Question.
Isn't Herzl kind of considered the father of
the father of the modern state.
No.
There were a lot of, he gets much more credit than he's due, in my opinion. Because of the emotional attachment people have to him. You know, remember, okay. Yeah, he did put out a tremendous amount of effort and sacrifice. I will admit that. But his practical accomplishments were next to nothing. He was simply a launching pad for the Zionist organization. And others will come after him, who will do much, much more, okay? At least in my opinion. You can disagree with me, that's fine. Okay, one more question.
Would you say that Blackstone accomplished more politically for
Zion? I don't know if Blackstone accomplished more politically, but he was part of the foundation. You know, in fact, remember he confronted Herzl with the Uganda product and gave him a Bible and said, you can't do this, you know? So Herzl was a secularist. Okay. All right, let's move on to the second Aliyah on page 80. Now, at the turn of the century, two groups of Jewish settlers could be found in the land, the Old Yishuv and the New Yishuv. And both groups depended mainly on outside help for survival. The Old Yishuv on the Chalukah charity system, and the New Yishuv on Rothschild and the Zionists. Jewish population totaled around 50,000, but only 5,000 were found in 20 rural colonies. So the first Aliyah had been less than successful in producing a new Jewish farmer. In 1903 came the Kishinev pogrom, and Russian Jews began making their way to the Holy Land in 1904. Russia was in turmoil at this time. She was involved in the Russo-Japanese War. Taking advantage of the situation, the liberal element in Russia staged an uprising demanding social reforms. Its hands tied by the war, the reactionary Russian government showed at first a willingness to conciliate the revolutionary movement. But when the war ended, the government turned against the rebel elements, the liberal elements, and the revolutionary movement was crushed in 1905. Now, the upheaval was suppressed by a nationwide chain reaction of pogroms. For the Jews, in fact, the attendant political and economic oppression was the grimmest yet in modern experience. Their survival as a people now literally hung in the balance. Accordingly, a massive new Jewish immigration overseas started and gained momentum each year until the outbreak of World War I. Now, in 1907, an appeal was issued from the Yishuv, especially by one Yosef Witkin. Witkin was a school teacher in a remote Galilee farm colony. Witkin insisted that departure for Palestine should neither be determined by mere doctrine, mere teaching, nor be inhibited by the earlier failures to enter the Holy Land. What was required now was simple courage and a mighty effort of chalutziut, a mighty effort of pioneering, chalutziut. And it was an eloquent plea. The vision of becoming chalutzim, becoming pioneers, suddenly exerted a new and compelling attraction. For the majority of the 30,000 Jews who departed for the Holy Land in the Second Aliyah between 1904 and 1914, Witkin's pioneering challenge was the catalyst. The 10-year wave of immigration began another aspect of Zionism called labor Zionism. Now, at the top of page 81, these four streams of Zionism that are now in existence are laid out for you. I've just created this little chart, but this information is at the top of page 81. So there's four streams of Zionism in existence right now, major streams from 1904 to 1914. We'll look at the type, the supporter, and the emphasis. The first type was political Zionism, and the major supporter was Herzl. The emphasis, politics. Second type was religious Zionism. The supporter was Mizrahi, and their emphasis was religious observance. The third type was spiritual or cultural Zionism, spearheaded by Achad Ha'am, and their emphasis was Jewish culture. And now comes the fourth type of Zionism, labor Zionism. And these people were socialists, and their emphasis was economics. So there's the situation in Zionism at this time. Now, the physical circumstances awaiting the newcomers in the land was bleak. Life was physically very harsh. In the largest Jewish village, Petach Tikva, the attitude of the established capitalist farmers, see, these guys are capitalists, and these guys coming now are socialists. The attitude of the established capitalist farmers was distinctly unfriendly and even hostile. So faced with this antagonism, the immigrants wandered from settlement to settlement in rags, the edge of collapse from malnutrition. David Ben-Gurion, a 19-year-old former student, was one of these immigrants. He succumbed to malaria and nearly died. We'll learn more about him. Possibly 80% of the Second Aliyah returned to Europe or continued on to America within weeks or months after their arrival. Perhaps only 2,000 hung on. Now, the onset of the Second Aliyah coincided with the growing momentum of Jewish agricultural settlements in Palestine. A number of new agricultural settlements was established by capable farmers. However, these settlements were more interested in creating productive villages than in fostering employment for the newcomers. All right, 1905, Seventh Zionist Congress. In 1905, the Seventh Zionist Congress met again in Basel from July 27th to August 2nd, 1905. And a huge void existed in the Congress due to the death of Herzl. And David Wolfson was elected as the president. Here's a picture of David Wolfson. He's the new president of the Congress. The Zionist Congress likewise gave urgent attention to its future stance. In overwhelming numbers, the delegates rejected any colonizing activities outside of Palestine and voted in favor of immigration and settlement there. That's a key sentence. No more temporary asylums for the night. We're going to focus on Palestine and Palestine alone. The Congress also voted to actively encourage Jewish agriculture and industry in the Holy Land. Now, it's interesting to note that up until this time, there had been many, many proposed homes for the Jewish people. And in Gilbert's book, Atlas of Jewish History, on page 102 and 103, he has a map he entitles Other Zions from 1652 to 1946. You will get these slides, the morning crew asked for them. Now let's take a look from 1652 to 1946. How many proposals for a home for the Jewish people were put forth? Number one, Dutch West Indies in the West Indies in 1652. Suriname, that's in South America. Dutch Guiana in 1654. The French West Indies in 1659. South America, an enclave in South America in 1730. Would you believe it? An enclave in the upper Mississippi and Missouri rivers in 1819. An enclave in Asia Minor, which is modern Turkey, in 1820. Niagara Falls, New York, 1825. There was a small enclave that got started there. It didn't last long. Syria, 1839. Crimea. Crimea is in the news today, isn't it? In the modern Ukraine. Give the Crimean Peninsula to the Jews, 1841. An enclave in Canada in 1884. Argentina, 1892. And we already looked at Cyprus in 1902 and Al-Arish in 1903 and Uganda in 1903. Brazil, 1904. Southern Mesopotamia in the area of Babylon, 1908 and 1909. Syrianisha in East Libya, 1908 and 1909. Australia, 1927. Birobidzhan in East Russia, 1928. Madagascar in 1940. And would you believe it? In 1946, Ho Chi Minh offered to David Ben-Gurion a temporary home in exile in Vietnam. Seriously, Ho Chi Minh offered it to David Ben-Gurion. Now, this brings me to question number 12. We've looked at 10 questions by our reporter friend, and then we looked at number 11, but I've got question number 12 for you here, okay? Question 12. 22 national homes for the Jewish people have been proposed from 1652 to 1946. Why did all of these proposals fail except for Israel, the historical homeland of the Jewish people? Why did they all fail? There you go. If we had taken Ho Chi Minh up on his offer and started a homeland in Vietnam, would that have fulfilled the Abrahamic covenant? No. What if we did a nice little enclave between the Mississippi and Missouri rivers? Would that have fulfilled the land covenant? Okay. All right. See, God wants the Jewish people in only one location in the world. No matter what the world tries to throw at us, He only will establish us in the land He promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Question.
And just a comment that when you see the homeless,
it's how busy Satan has been trying to somehow pervert the land covenant and therefore the Abrahamic covenant. Okay, let me. We're just running out of time. One more comment.
What an application of this whole thing. Sometimes have doors ever slammed closed in your life because it just wasn't the time, even though it made sense?
Right. It seemed to make sense, but it wasn't the time or the place. Right. We have to trust the Lord. Yeah. All righty. Now, on page 81, pogroms in Russia and Poland continue. Mass emigration continues. Then 1906, the Hebrew High School is established in Jaffa. And we will pick it up next week on page 82, top of page 82. We'll pick it up with David Ben-Gurion. All righty, let's go ahead and let me pray, and I'll turn you loose. Father, again, we're reminded by your word, without me you can do nothing. So, Lord, help us take that to heart and not act out of ignorance or arrogance, out of chutzpah, but help us to remember that anything we do of any eternal value only comes because you have chosen to use us as your servants. And help us to rejoice in that position. And we look forward to the time when you will say, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." Help us not to follow in the footsteps of Theodore Herzl. Help us to be humble and appreciative of all you've done in our lives. And we ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week.